And we're off. Okay. All right. Well, welcome everybody. It doesn't seem that long ago since we met first, which I think was back in February. So nice to see you all again. I hope most of you are still speaking to me at this stage. And then those of you that send me loads of thank yous every time you get a good mark, you're very welcome. It's all part of the job. So quite a bit to get through, I'll crack immediately into it. So what we'll probably do is we'll go, first of all, we'll go through the mock paper, which hopefully you all received and hopefully you all had a chance to look at. First of all, does anyone need a copy of the mock paper? Does everybody have a copy in front of them? Because if I'm talking through answers and you don't have the questions in front of you, it's not going to mean an awful lot. Okay, one for you. Anybody else? No, we're all good. Okay, next. So what we'll do is we'll go through the mock paper itself. So the reason I want to do that is I want to give you a flavour as to, you know, the whole idea of it is to give you an example as to how we'd be looking for you to answer the questions. Okay, so I will give you the answers as we're going through it for the mock paper. Okay, so we'll do that. We'll do that for probably about 40 minutes. Now that doesn't leave a huge amount of time. It leaves about 5 minutes per question because there's actually 8 of them. Even though you only have to do 4 in the actual exam, there are actually 8 on the paper. I'm going to go through all 8 of them. So no point in me picking my 4 favourites because they might be your 4 favourites. Okay, so we're going through all 8. So that leaves only about 5 minutes per question. So we'll go through. It won't be in too much massive detail, but I'll tell you what we'd be looking for in terms of the answers, and there'll be some, I suppose, ideas as to how you should go about answering the real one as we go through that. That will leave us another 20 minutes or so, which is very important, so I will then, I'll shut down that paper and I will, only on the screen, I will open up my own version of the real paper, okay? So law is, and there's a privacy screen on it as well, law is obviously a very big topic. There's a hell of a lot of reading involved in it, so what I'll do is I'll try and narrow it down for you, because if you were to read every single word of it and go through it a number of times and learn it all off, you'd probably need to start this afternoon and maybe take 2 weeks off work, which isn't really going to be practical, so we will narrow it down a bit. And Declan, as the years have gone on, Declan sets the paper, I correct the paper, but Declan has become a nicer and nicer man as the years have gone on, so he does make it a bit easier on you. It wasn't as easy when I was doing the course, believe me. Okay, sound good?
Yeah.
Okay, very good. So if we crack into it, first of all, taking the mock paper. If we look at question one, so first of all, to be clear, because it's probably no harm that I mention this a number of times, there's 8 questions on it, you only have to do 4, and the time allocated for the exam is 2 hours, okay? So I'm going to repeat this later on, but that is, but please allocate your time evenly, that's half an hour per question, max, okay? There's no point in spending 50 minutes answering one question, because the absolute max you can get is the marks that are there. One thing to clarify, actually, on the mock paper, you may have noticed everything is marked out at 20 on each question. On the real paper, it's actually 25, okay, so it should add up to 100, okay. Just to clarify again, just before I get into the mock paper, in terms of the marking system, there is 70% of your marks are available for the exam that you're going to do in 2 weeks' time, okay. All right. So in terms of where the other 30 marks are, there's 10 available for the contract assignment, which I think at this stage you've all done. There's 10 available for the TORT assignment, which most of you have done. And then there's another 10 available for the 4 short tests that you would have done as well. I think I've pretty much all of them back as well at this stage. So you've 2.5%. Declan's next door, yeah.
I'm in the wrong course.
Oh, all right. He was wondering. He said there were a couple of people missing.
Yeah.
No, this is law. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. I'll be seeing you in a few minutes then, in an hour's time. Okay. So is that clear in terms of the marking? Okay. 70% for the exam, 10 for the contract, 10 for tort, and 10 for the other 4 assignments, short assignments put together. Okay. Okay. This quiz girl kind of looks. Well, that's in relation to her. Okay. Okay. So to crack on, in terms of the mock exam, so question one in the mock exam, which like I said, hopefully you've read, question one is in 2 parts, okay? 10 marks out of 20 each, okay? So you should be allocating your time evenly throughout those 2, okay? So if you've half an hour per question, that's 15 minutes for the first half and 15 minutes for the second half. Do it evenly, okay? You'd be surprised how often I get a really, really, really good answer for the first half of the question, and then a little paragraph for the second bit, and that's presumably because people run out of time, okay? All right, so do allocate your time evenly, okay? I cannot give you extra marks that aren't there, okay? So first question is, outline and briefly describe the primary sources of law in Ireland, okay? So there's four of them. Okay, 4/5. Okay, the first one is common law and judicial precedent. Okay, which I've rolled in together because they're basically the same thing. Second one is the Irish Constitution. Third one is statutory legislation, which the Dáil and the Seanad, and then ultimately the President, sign into law. And then finally, you have EU law. Okay. And then under EU law, you have primary legislation, which is primary legislation, which is the treaties themselves, and then you have secondary legislation, which is what they do on a day-to-day basis in the EU. Okay. So those four. So for the half of that question, you know, those are the four things I'm looking for. Okay. So under common law and judicial precedent. So I mean, explain what they are. Essentially what common law is that it's, you know, the law is based on the series of judgments. So case one is built, you know, case two is built on case one, case three is built on case two, and so on. So it's a case law, it's nothing, it's the judges basically make the law as they go along. So explain to me what common law is, okay? And then you have judicial precedent, okay? So the logic of that being that we don't ignore the previous case. So you won't have a case on a Monday and then have exactly the same case on a Tuesday, and then the judge in the case on the Tuesday ignores whatever was done in case one on the Monday. They will be looking back and seeing what are cases that are similar to this and what potentially are the differences of it, okay? So you do need to explain that to me, okay? Do bring in the concept of equity as well, okay? Equity means justice, okay? So once upon a time, when common law first came around, that was the way they worked. They said, okay, is the case the same as the last one? Yep, okay, it's the same judgment as the last one. Is the case different to the last one? Okay, different judgment to the last one. It paid no attention to the actual, whether or not this was right or whether it was wrong, the actual justice of the actual actual decision, okay? So equity came in the 1800s, equity began coming in, and it's now a big part of law, okay? But that basically is, in a nutshell, that's basically common law and judicial precedent, okay? The Irish Constitution is the second one, okay? So briefly explain to me that you understand what the Irish Constitution is, came into effect in 1937, what it regulates. I mean, it regulates the structure, function, principal organs of government. It guarantees certain personal rights in relation to family, rights in relation to education, private property, rights of religion, and it can only be changed by a referendum. So, I mean, those are the basic key points of the, you know, if you give me those points, it's clear you know what the Constitution is, okay? Statutory legislation, okay, falls into two categories, the superior legislation and the subordinate legislation, okay. Superior legislation are the important laws of our country, okay, water charges, bans on smoking in the workplace, those type of really key decisions, they all come from superior legislation, okay. So bill is proposed, you don't need to go through the entire process as to how you get there, but I mean, in short, the bill passes through the two houses of the Oireachtas, goes to the Taoiseach, then presents it to the President to be signed off. If the President is not happy with it, he or she will either refer it to the Council of State or will refer it to the Supreme Court for guidance. Okay, that in short is your superior legislation. And then subordinate legislation is even shorter. I mean, that's just basically the bylaws that we have in our country, things like littering and dumping and things like that, things that you don't necessarily want your parliament tied up in discussing, unless it's particularly severe. And then finally, the fourth source of common law, law in Ireland, is the EU, okay? So again, it's divided into two sections. You have the primary legislation, so just quickly explain to me what primary legislation is. You don't need to list off, I mean, there's about 7 or 8 different treaties there. You don't necessarily, certainly for this question, you wouldn't necessarily need to list them all off, okay? Then the secondary legislation, which consists of regulations, directives, decisions, and also recommendations and opinions. Okay, so just briefly explain to me. And when I say briefly, I'm talking kind of maybe a line, you know, max a line each on what those are. Okay. All right. Now you do have to keep in mind, you know, it's 10 marks. Okay, the absolute max I can give you on it is 10 marks. Okay, so you know, I think I'll have a good knowledge of it after I've seen all the exams, but I think a maybe rough rule of thumb might be, I mean, in half an hour, you can probably write no more than 2 pages. You know, if you get beyond 2 pages, you're doing pretty well. If there's 10 marks available and 20 marks in total for the question, you know, give it a page, okay? So divide it up, you know? Like I said, I mean, if it's divided up and looks even throughout, if there's 4 things to cover and they're all evenly covered, I get the impression, okay, this is somebody who evenly knows what there is to know about these, okay? If somebody has given me 3/4 of the page
common law and judicial precedent, and then say, oh, by the way, there's also EU law and there's also that. You know, in my head, I'm kind of saying, okay, it's the right answer, but do they really know what EU law means? Do they really know what the Constitution is? You know, it doesn't give. So do show off evenly throughout the four things you want to cover off. Okay.
So next one. So second part of that question, which we'll go through a little bit faster, is outline the principal differences between civil law and criminal law. Okay. So it is important to say. I mean, do read the actual words that are in the question. You know, things like outline, briefly describe. You know, they're telling you what we want to get. Okay. You know, it does. Being very honest and to slightly oversimplify it, you know, we're looking for the notes, okay? Being honest, okay, you want the notes in front of you, we're looking for the notes. What will always get you a higher score is if you give me a good impression that you understand what you're saying, okay? You could theoretically give me 2 pages of quantum physics, and if you give me long enough, I'll learn it all off, and I can regurgitate it in an exam. I won't have a clue what I'm saying, though, okay? So do give the impression that you're not me reading through 2 pages of quantum physics and then putting it in an exam. Give me an impression that you understand it. Okay? But basically, that's what it's looking for. I mean, if it's outline and briefly describe, then that's what we're looking for you to do. If we say discuss, on the other hand, discuss for me means give me the advantages, give me the disadvantages, and what do you think? Is it a good thing or is it a bad thing? Okay? Not necessarily a wrong answer on that one, okay? All right? But do back up whatever answer you come to. Okay, but getting back to the mock exam, so outline the principal differences between civil law and criminal law in Ireland. That's the second part of question one, okay? So what are the principal differences? So civil proceedings are initiated by private individuals and companies, whereas criminal proceedings are initiated by the state, okay? Every criminal case is the DPP versus the defendant, okay? Candice, do you have a copy of the paper?
No, I do not. Okay. I have it on my phone as well.
Yep, okay. So that's the first difference. Okay, some of the categories that you have in civil law, contract and tort, which you're presumably pretty well familiar with at this stage, commercial law and employment law, these are all examples of civil proceedings. Criminal proceedings, obviously, you know, all you need to do is open the newspaper and you can kind of come up with a list of what they are. Principal differences, let me see. So in civil cases, there is a plaintiff and a defendant. Okay, the plaintiff is taking the action. The defendant is trying to get out of whatever it is that they're being accused of. In civil law, the burden of proof may shift on occasion. So it depends on the case, really, as to whether or not the plaintiff is the person who really needs to prove their case, or whether the defendant really needs to prove that they did not do what they're being accused of, or did do what they were supposed to do. In civil law, there's various remedies. So, I mean, the remedies that you get in civil cases, you know this yourselves from what you did on the contract and the tort stuff. You know, there's damages, there's injunctions, there's specific performance and of a contract, and then there's the opposite, which is the rescission of the contract. Okay, so those are the things you're looking for if you're launching a civil case. You want one of those things. In criminal law, what is it that the state is looking for? They're either looking to imprison the defendant, they're looking to fine the defendant, they want the defendant to complete community service, or they're looking for the defendant to agree to bind to the peace, so basically to behave themselves for the next X amount of years. So that basically, I mean, that's it in a nutshell. I mean, that's what, you know, there's only a page or so, as I said. I mean, that's what we're looking for. What are the differences between civil and criminal proceedings? Okay? Okay, so in terms of comparing the real paper with the mock one, I'll do that now at the end when we get to the real paper. But are there any questions specifically on that? No? Great. Okay. So question two, describe how common law has evolved and explain how it is applied to the court system in Ireland. Okay, I'll be honest, trickier question than question one. Okay, more reading and probably more writing. Okay? But if you choose to do it, basically the answer we'd be looking for is, prior to the arrival of the Normans in 1171, Ireland was governed by Brehon law. Okay, when the Normans arrived in 1171, there was about 425 years or so, up all the way up to 1601, of conflict between the two, both in the courts and outside of the courts. So you had Brehon law versus the common law system. In 1601, the Irish chieftains were defeated in the Battle of Kinsale, so Brehon law basically died off at that stage. In 1800, so there's a series of kind of key dates in this. In the year 1800, there was the Act of the Union, so that meant that all laws in the UK became law in Ireland as well, automatically.
Equity comes up again in this discussion. So again, after the common law system, equity began to come in the 1800s. It was seen as a way of appealing the harsher decisions and to make justice a little bit fairer. You could briefly discuss the kind of maxims of equity, which is that he who comes with equity come with clean hands. So that kind of scenario that justice plays a part in it. You would also then discuss judicial precedent, which we've already discussed as well. Okay, so that's the final part of the common law piece. Okay, so a little bit of a snapshot of history there, followed by you had common law on its own, then equity came in, and then finally judicial precedent, whereby we do both. We look at what's the right thing to do, but we also don't ignore the cases that have gone before it. Okay. So that's one half of the questions. Now, the way the marks are broken down for this one is there was actually 12 marks for the first one and only 8 for the second one, so you should spend a little bit more time. If you have half an hour, I did the maths on it, so you should basically spend 18 minutes. If you're being really clinical about it, you should spend 18 minutes on the first half and only 12 on the second half. Okay? Now, that said, I don't think the questions, I'll double check when we're doing the real one, but I don't think the marking system is the same in the real one. I don't think you have 12s and 8s, or I think it's more kind of half and half or the whole lot together, okay? But I'll confirm once I look at the real paper. But that basically is how you'd answer the first question of that. Second one, a bit more straightforward, explain the system of the courts in the Irish civil court system, okay? All right, so nice and straightforward. So you just work your way up through the court system. You start with the district court, 60 district court judges, covering 23 different regions, and the jurisdiction is up to 15,000. Okay, if the maximum amount of damages can be awarded is greater than 15,000, the case might start off in the district court, but all the judge will do is he or she will kick it up to the circuit court. Okay, which is the next one. Okay, circuit court, the threshold is 75,000. Okay, and there's 37 circuit court judges floating around at any one time, and they work off 8 different districts. Okay. You can also explain what the structure of the court is. The circuit court can cover criminal cases. In such cases, you have a judge and a jury. Okay, so juries do operate in the circuit court system. Okay. You then move on to the High Court. Okay, jurisdiction of the High Court extends to all matters of law, so it can be civil or criminal. So they can do civil cases, they also do criminal ones. High Court structure is a president of the High Court, and there's also a judge of the Supreme Court, and you remember the Council of State. So you normally have 3 judges at any one time. There's 35, I was actually surprised to hear that, but there's 35 High Court judges in this country at the moment. Okay? So normally the way it works is you can have the judge sitting on its own, but you can have 3 judges. Okay, it depends on the case. Okay? All right? You can also have juries in the High Court, even for civil cases. Okay? You will have things like defamation and so on, which are not necessarily criminal cases, but you will have jurors in there as well, okay? And when the High Court is hearing, you'll hear this on the news, when the High Court is hearing a criminal case, it's still the High Court, but it's known as the Central Criminal Court, okay? Sorry, did I say? Yeah, when it's hearing a criminal case, it's known as the Central Criminal Court. It's only the most serious criminal ones. Most crimes are tried in the Circuit Court. It's only the most serious ones that are done in the High Court, things like murder and things like that. Okay. You then have the Court of Criminal Appeal. Okay, this Court of Criminal Appeal hears appeals from the Circuit Court or the Central Criminal Court or even the Special Criminal Court, which we don't go into in much detail here, but which was set up. It's judges only, no juries. We've had a couple of versions of it over the years, but it was set up most recently to cope with the gangland crime in Limerick. So the court there consists of 3 judges. One comes from the Supreme Court and the other 2 are from the High Court. And the judge's decision is by majority, the court's decision is by majority. So if you have two versus one, then whatever the ruling is for the two is the winning one. Okay? And then finally, I'm conscious that time is ticking on, finally we have the Supreme Court, okay? So Supreme Court's final resort. It has 7 judges. 3 will be needed in order to get a decision. So basically, I mean, it's in there in the notes, but that's the way. And the Supreme Court is your last hope, basically within Ireland. Now you can ultimately appeal to. You can briefly mention the European Court of Justice, but you can potentially appeal to them. But that's only on European matters. Okay, if you feel that your law a law has been broken, and it is enshrined in the treaties or it is enshrined in the European regulations, then you can go to the ECJ if it's an Irish-only law and it doesn't exist in France or Spain or anywhere else in the EU,
and the Supreme Court is your final source. Any questions on that? No? Very good. Okay. So question three, again, comes in two parts. Again, it's 12 and 8, so 18 minutes on one, 12 minutes on the other. First question is, explain the essential elements of contract. Now, you all did an assignment on this a number of weeks ago. Every single one of you got this right, okay, without exception. Okay, everybody got all four, okay? Do you need me to cover it off again? Are you happy enough with offer acceptance, consideration,
yeah.
Intention of legal relations? Yeah, okay. So I'd rather spend the time on anything that maybe we are a little bit, maybe might be a little bit fuzzier on, okay? Okay, great. So that's the first part. Okay, second part is explain what is meant by terms of a contract and give examples, okay? So terms of a contract fall into a couple of categories, okay? You have express terms and then you have implied terms, okay? So express terms are actually called out in the contract, okay? Good example of that would be, I mean, if I have a contract to do work for a company, you know, what is work? You know, work could be anything, okay? And then say, you know, so you almost certainly in the contract say, work for Paul will be the following things, or to call out what Paul's going to do, okay? All right? Implied terms. These are implied through common law, statute, constitution, and custom, okay? Possibly the best implied term that I could probably suggest would be, I mean, if you go into a contract to buy a car, there's a pretty good chance the car is supposed to go, all right? Unless you, you know, now if coincidentally you happen to be buying a car that is, you know, I don't know, that is a wreck, it'll probably actually become an express term because you'll probably say, you know, if I'm the person selling it, I'm going to say, by the way, this car does not go, and I'm putting that in the contract, all right? Okay? So there'll be implied term and condition that the car goes, all right? And that's not going to die on the way out of the car parking lot, okay? All right? So there's an example of express term, an example of an implied term, okay? So in terms of what is covered under express terms, I mean, there's a couple of different categories. You have things which are known as mere representations, okay? So these are not binding, okay? So if I happen to mention, oh, by the way, the car is blue, okay? Car I'm selling you is blue. So, okay, right, car is blue. You know, if you come to me looking for a blue car, and I sell you a red car, that's not fulfilling the contract. If you come to me just looking for a car, I say, by the way, the car is blue, and then you end up getting, oh, it actually changed plan, I'm going to give you a red one instead. It's not necessarily a strong enough case to rescind the contract, okay? You probably may have to go ahead, you may have to go ahead with it, okay? So the fact that the car is blue is known as a mere representation, okay? Then under the stronger terms that you have there, you have conditions and you have warranties, okay? Condition is a vital term of the contract, okay? Okay? So if I'm contracting to sell you a car, you know, the fact that it's a car and not a van or a Jeep or a boat is a key part of the condition, okay? Then there's also warranties, which are more minor terms of the contract. Maybe I say to you, okay, I'm going to sell you, I don't know, maybe, what's the best example? I don't know, I'm going to sell you a Ford car or something like that. And then when it comes to actually doing it, I'll sell you something that's maybe ever so slightly different, okay? Virtually the same type of car, but same year, same mileage. Virtually the same type of car, but maybe not quite a Ford car. That potentially might be a warranty. All right. Okay. It's warranty. Not warranty. I'll say a couple of. There's one thing to point out. There is a couple of cases in there. Okay. So anything to do with contract law, if you have an opportunity to show off the case law, it will increase your marks. Okay. A little bit difficult in that one. Quite easy in the offer and acceptance piece, okay, if you're discussing anything to do with that, it's case law all over the place, okay? Things like implied terms and so on, maybe there's a little bit less on the case law. But don't go into the facts, you know, to say, this reminds me of Paul versus Deccan. Put it in that way, all right? Or this is different to Paul versus Deccan, here's why, okay? Put it in that way. You don't need to spend, your time is precious. You don't need to spend time telling me all the facts of the Carlisle case. You can assume I know it, okay? So that's express terms, and then finally there's implied terms, okay? So the test that's used for the implied terms is known as the officious bystanders test. So if the reasonable man, if you like, would say, yeah, that should be fairly obvious that the car has to go. If the reasonable man, or if you stop 100 people in the street and they all say, yeah, I'd expect the car to go, then there's a fair chance that can be seen to be implied. If you stop 100 people in the street and 50 of them give you one answer and 50 give the other, then you probably need to be calling it out in the contract as an express term, not implied. Okay? All right. So that's basically what I'd be looking for question three. Any questions on any of that? Okay. So question four, I'll have to speed up even more. So this is in relation to company law. So in relation to company law, explain how a private limited company differs from that of a sole trader. And thankfully, there's 20 marks available for this, so I only have to cover one topic rather than two. So there's full 20 marks available for that. Okay, so that means we're expecting more. Okay, so if we take kind of two pages as being kind of a guideline, you'd want to be spending the full two pages talking about this. But basically, there's four answers. Okay, four things we'll be looking for, which were called out. This was one of the questions in one of the short tests, I think. So legally separate from the owners, limited liability, transferable shares, and continuous existence. Okay, so first of all, legally separate from the owners. Okay, so I mean, a company is different. You know, when you're a sole trader, you are the company. Okay, you are the company. Okay, and if the company goes bust and you owe a load of money, they can come after you for your house, your car, your holiday home in Spain. They come after all that stuff. Okay, none of it's protected. Okay, it's all fair game when the creditors come knocking if you owe money. All right. If you are a limited company, however, it's not the case. Okay, if you're a director of a limited company, your house, as long as your house is your house and not the company's house, is protected. Okay, the creditors cannot go after it. Okay, so that's a key difference between being a sole trader versus a limited company. Okay, that you're legally separate. Okay, now there's a flip side as well. It also means that if you're a sole trader, any of the assets are also your assets. You know, you can use them on weekends, you can use them you can use them on your holidays, you use them whatever way you want. When something belongs to the company, there may be rules in relation to how you use them, okay? You can't just, where that becomes, I suppose, most clear is money, okay? If you're broke, if you're the director and you're pretty much broke, but the company has a million, you can't just use that million for whatever it is that you want to use it for, okay? It's company money, okay? That's why you occasionally have cases, as the example is given here, of Salomon versus Salomon and Company Limited, where you have companies suing directors of companies, okay? All right, so you might be the person to set up the company, but you're still a company, it's not you, all right? So that's the first thing. Limited liability, okay? With every downside comes an upside, okay? So limited liability, okay? So as I just explained, if the company goes bust, you're not liable, so I mean, the way it'll work with the company going bust is whatever money is available, liquidator may be appointed, which we'll cover off separately, but liquidator could be appointed, might divide up the assets of the company. If you're the director of the company, you walk away, you take your bloody nose, and maybe you start again with another company a year or so later, okay? All right, so limited liability, okay? To encourage people to take risks, there's limited liability, okay? You are not liable. If money gets written off, money gets written off, okay? May impact things like your credit rating. The bank might be as keen. Say, oh, hang on, isn't that the guy who left us a load of money last time? Bank might be as keen to give you the money, but you're ultimately not liable for it. Okay. Transferable shares is the third one. Okay. So companies should theoretically be able to go on forever. Okay. So if I'm a sole trader and I retire, that's it. The business is finished. Okay. If I'm part of a partnership and I retire, the business is finished. Okay. If I'm part of a company, however, I should be able to sell on. If I think the company is worth, the company is valued at a million, I own a quarter of it, I should be able to take 250,000 out of the company, sell my shares on to somebody else, who will then buy those shares and the company continues trading. Okay, transferable shares, and then the last one is continuous existence. Okay, the company should theoretically be able to go on forever. Sole traders go die with the sole trader. Partnerships die with the retirement or death of one of the two people involved in the partnership. Companies theoretically go on forever. Okay. Continuous existence was the fourth one. Yeah. Okay. Very good. So we're halfway through. Question five. Explain the role of each of the following as defined in company law. So we have a company director. We have an auditor. And we have a liquidator. 5 marks for the company director, 5 marks for the auditor, 10 for the liquidator, okay? So once again, I know I'm sounding like a cracked record, but spend half your time on the liquidator and then divide up the rest of your time 50-50 between the company director and the auditor, okay? Good news is you can kind of more, one kind of crashes into the other in terms of the answer, so you can kind of cover it off. But do, I'll be honest with you, I like an easy life. You know, do separate the stuff, okay? Don't throw all the stuff. Don't give me all the entire answer and throw it all in one big mishmash. Do kind of call out, this is part one, this is part two, this is part three, okay? It does make it easier to correct and makes it more likely you score higher marks, okay? So company director, okay, so what does a company director have to do? So the 1990 Companies Act place new rules on the new rules and responsibilities on the directors of limited companies. Okay, so companies were held personally liable for non-compliance with statutory legislation. Okay, so what is it they have to actually do? They have to file a return every year. Okay, size of the return and what's in the return varies depending on the size of the company, but they have to decide. They have to file an annual return with the company's registration office once a year. Okay, otherwise they are personally liable for fines, penalties, and even prison. Okay? And it must be accurate. Okay? So let's give a fair and accurate view. Okay? So I won't go into the full history as to why that's the case, but basically it loads of companies that were existing but weren't kind of doing this, so people were losing money left, right, and centre. So in order to stop that, the government brought this act in. Okay? All right? So file your returns, must give a fair and accurate view, must be kept for 6 years. If you don't do it, you're liable to criminal prosecution. That basically is, I mean, I know directors do an awful lot more, but I mean, in terms of the actual director, directors aren't necessarily involved in the day-to-day running of the business, okay? They will attend board meetings and so on, but they're not necessarily there every day. So that is essentially what the role of the director is, okay? Now, a second requirement, which I suppose is where it crashes into the second part of the question, is they are also required to make sure the accounts get audited, okay? You can't just file it and say, I check them, nobody else checked them. You need to have independent auditors that go through them, okay? So that's the auditor's role, okay? The auditor's role is to go through, so every company must appoint an auditor or auditors to go through the books. They need to go through it, obviously giving false or misleading information, be it the auditor who does it or the director, also could potentially land you in trouble. But that basically is the role of the auditor, okay? Review the books, okay? A little bit of detail in there in the notes, but that's basically what it is they're expected to do, okay? And then the liquidator. So the liquidator, as I said, you'll spend about half your time discussing this one. Liquidator is defined as a person who conducts a liquidation or a winding up of a company. Once appointed, they must notify the register of companies, who will in turn notify the ODCE. Regardless of the type of liquidation, liquidator's general function is the same as every situation. It's only the appointment of the liquidator that varies. Their duties are, there's five of them. They need to take possession of the company's assets and protect them, so to stop the company selling them off. They need to make a list of the debtors and creditors of the company. They need to have disputed cases adjudicated upon them by the courts. They need to sell off the assets of the company, and they need to use that money to pay off the debts in order of priority. Okay, you don't necessarily need to get into the order of the, you know, it's listed there as to who gets paid first. First person to get paid is actually the liquidator themselves, but you don't need to go into the full details of that. But that basically is what the liquidator's role is. Okay. So give me an indication, you know, I mean, you don't have an awful lot of room there in terms of time, but I mean, you know, give me an indication that you understand what it is that I'm talking about, okay? If you've listed it off, stuff you learned from the notes, yep, you'll definitely pass, you'll probably do more than pass, because you will have answered the question, but if you're really shooting for top marks, give me an indication you understand what you're talking about as well. Question six, explain the primary source of law in the EU and give examples as to how it's applied in the national courts. Okay, so that's the first part of the question. The second one is explain the outline and briefly describe the secondary sources of EU law. Okay, so on this one, unlike the earlier one, which was part of a smaller question, I would just quickly call out what the treaties are here, okay, because that's basically what the primary sources of the law are. Okay. So call out the treaties, maybe put in four or five words as to what each treaty actually did, okay? All right, there's a purpose. Call out in the notes quite clearly. There's a purpose to each treaty, okay? Just call out briefly what they are. There's 1, 2, 3, 7 of them, okay? That'll be the first thing I put in that part of the question. The second thing I put in is the four main principles of the EU, okay? Because this is ultimately, when you roll all of the treaties up together, there's four things that they're trying to achieve. They're trying to achieve free movement of goods, free movement of workers, right of establishment, right of establishment, free movement of services, and free movement of capital, okay? That's basically why the EU exists, okay? You don't need to go into Brexit or anything like that, just call out, you don't need to discuss whether it's a good thing or a bad thing, you can leave that for a different exam, all right? Whether it's seven treaties, quickly call out what they are. Five principles of the EU, quickly call out what they are. Show me you understand, job done. Okay? Second part of that question is the secondary sources of law, okay? So there's a few of these. There's not too many, there's four. 4/5, okay? So you have regulations, first of all, okay? So regulations are applicable and binding on us all, okay? It's an EU law, all right? If
you're part of the EU, this is the law, you're going to win. Regulation is passed, it is binding on, what is it, 400 million of us, 400 or 500 million of us, okay? So binding upon us, okay? Then you have directives, okay? So the EU issues directives. Member states then have to figure out how they implement it, okay? The directive might be, we are going to be, it'll be more specific than this, but might be we're going to live a green life, all right? We're going to recycle, let's put it that way, we're going to recycle. It's up to the countries themselves to work out how we're going to do it. Are we going to pay people to recycle? Are we going to incentivize them? Are we going to fine them for dumping? What is it we're going to do? So the countries themselves figure it out. But the directive from the EU is we will recycle, okay? It might be a bit more specific than that, but that's basically what it is, okay? So regulations bind us all. Directives bind the countries who then have to then in turn bind us, okay? Decisions, okay? So decisions of the Council and Commission are binding immediately and upon those to which they're addressed. So decisions do not apply to all 400 or 500 million of it. It might be a decision that impacts only farmers, I suppose is probably the best example, okay? The decisions can be that this will be the way the world will work. It applies to farmers. It does not apply to you and I if you are not a farmer, okay? And finally, recommendations and opinions, okay? This is kind of general strategic direction. It kind of says, okay, this is the way we want the EU to gradually go, okay? We want it to be a very inclusive EU, we want it to be a non-inclusive EU, we want it to be, you know, whatever it is, general direction we're saying. So these are recommendations that come out of the Council and come out of the Commission. They're not binding, they're merely persuasive. Because they're not binding, they are considered to be less important than the previous instruments, okay? So it might be that people might raise in the national parliament and say, okay, this is the way the EU wants us to go. So the EU might put pressure on us to work in a certain way, but they're not necessarily binding, okay? Whereas regulations, directives are, okay? Okay, so plenty of stuff there to cover in two and a bit pages. So we're nearly there. Question 7. Explain each essential element which must be proven by the plaintiff in order to establish negligence. And also discuss the various defences which the defendant may rely upon. Okay. Now, so far, in terms of this is in the tort exam. I haven't got every single tort assignment back, but every single one of you got this right as well. Okay. So duty of care, breach to the duty of care, damage must be suffered, and there must be a causal link between the two. Okay. So from what I'm getting from the assignments back, everybody understands what's in that. Okay. If you don't, and if you're struggling with it, maybe give me a shout outside of this meeting, we can have a call or something to discuss it. Okay? So I'll probably skip over that if that's all right. Okay? Now, in terms of the defences, when I get to them, yeah, so just very quickly on the defences. Sorry, just want to look at the structure of the question just for a moment. That's all 20 marks, but it is important you do both. Okay? So it says explain each essential element. Okay? So explain is a little bit stronger than outline. Okay? So explain is tell me, show me, understand. Okay, and discuss the various defences that the defendant may rely upon. Okay, so it says discuss. Do you think it's good? Do you think it's bad? All right. So the defences themselves. So do balance it up. Okay, if it's one long sentence and it has okay, tell me this and tell me that, you can basically take it as though it's in two separate parts as well. All right. Okay. So 10 marks and 10 marks. Okay. So your defences. There are 5 of them, if I remember correctly. 6. So there's contributory negligence, okay? There's a couple of cases in there, no harm to call them out. There is res ipsa licitor, which is basically the facts speak for themselves, okay? So that's the defense that the defendant will sometimes rely upon. Consent of the plaintiff, okay? If you do a parachute jump and you sign away your life, you can't then sue when you break your leg, all right? So there are such things as waivers for dangerous things. Okay, a couple of cases there, but no harm to call them out. Inevitable accident, so the accident happened regardless of what the defendant did. You know, defendant took all possible precautions and you still ended up with an accident. Sometimes that happens. That's
what,
a defense.
What's the name of that? Okay.
Inevitable accident. Okay, so the defendant says, well, listen, I took every single precaution I could possibly take and yet there was still an accident. Sometimes that happens. Okay. Necessity, best example of that is CPR. If you break somebody's ribs, performing CPR, you can certainly rely on the defence of necessity because they were going to die if you did not do the CPR. Okay, and then finally, statute of limitations. You have a 3-year limitation for tort. Okay, so you gotta act fast. Okay, do it for 4 years. If I'm the defendant, I can potentially wriggle out of it. Okay.
So we've one more to go, and then we get on to the main exam, where you really all will move forward in your seats. So question 8, there are, was it 5, I think, terms that we need to describe? 5 terms? There are 5 on that? 5? Yeah. Okay, so nice and simple. As long as you know all 5, this is a fairly easy one to do. I mean, explain the meaning. There are a couple of bits to it, though. That's the only thing I'll say to you. Explain the meaning of each of the following. Identify the area of law in which it came. Okay, so I know when I was putting the notes together, I paid careful attention to make sure I wrote that down. And cite a relevant case for case law for each one. Okay, so that might be, I mean, I'll have to look at the final exam now in a minute, but I mean, that might be one that might potentially trip you up, because you need to know 5 bits from 5 different parts of the course, and also a case. So you might need to have a good spread of it. But in any case, I'll compare it with the real one. There's a similar question in the real one. And I'll see if that case bit is in there or not. I might be flexible on it. So first one was uber dictum. Okay, so this comes from judicial precedent. Okay, so the very first module. Okay, and basically it means by the way. Okay, and if you think of judicial precedent, you're always looking at the previous cases. Okay, so there's 2 things that you take into account when you're a judge applying judicial precedent. One is known as ratio decidendi, which is the reason for the decision. Okay, so I have come to the decision, and this is why I've come to the decision. It's different to the other case because this is my logic. All right. Then you have obiter dictum, which is by the way, which is everything else. Okay, so judges talk an awful lot when they're doing their judgments. Okay, so they say an awful lot of things. So you can't. What obiter dictum ultimately means is you can't just randomly pick a bit from the previous judgment and say I'm relying on that. The judge might have said it, but he or she might ultimately have said, but that said, this is the way I'm going, okay? You can't rely on the first bits, okay? All right, that's what obiter dictum means, okay? Second one is the literal rule, which again comes from the sources of law in Ireland, so towards the beginning, okay? And what the literal rule basically means is a judge will give words their literal or usual meaning unless the act defines or restricts the meaning it's taken, all right? Okay, this comes from the sources. This comes from the statutory legislation part of the sources of law. So think way back to the first question we did, statutory legislation. So the literal rule will apply. The rule just basically says a judge will give words their literal and usual meaning unless the act defines or restricts the meaning to be taken. Okay. So work might again be an example. Probably you won't find the word work in too much statutory legislation, but general word like work. The judge will have to apply some meaning to it, but he will apply it to whatever way the normal people out there on the street would interpret such a word. Okay. So caveat emptor, you're possibly fairly familiar with that one. That comes from the Sale of Goods Act. Okay, I came up in discussion with Bobby Byrne. I keep thinking Bobby Brown, but Bobby Byrne, and the medicine. Okay, so caveat emptor. Okay, let the buyer beware. Okay, that's basically what it means. All right. Invitation to treat, you should also be fairly aware of. That comes from contract law as well. So, I mean, what does an invitation to treat mean? It basically means an offer to receive offers. Invitation to treat is when you go into your Tesco, your local Tesco, and there's all these products, that's an invitation for you to buy the products, okay? All right? They don't have to accept, okay? So it's an offer to receive offers. And then finally, the very last one there, ultra vires, which comes from company law. Basically means, so it's similar to our discussion point earlier on of the difference between sole traders and non-sole traders. So I mean, if you think about it, well it is and it isn't, I suppose. I mean, so basically, I mean, what ultra vires means is, you know, companies when they're established have to have a purpose. Okay, you will set out in the memorandums of association what it is this company is going to do. Okay, and as you've seen, I don't have the examples here in front of me, but I mean, there's various examples that companies were kind of set up to kind of be dressmakers, and they ended up kind of you know, trading in pigs. You know, that's not what the company is set up to do. Okay, so any basically rules means that anything or any money advanced for buying pigs, when you know perfectly well the company is supposed to be a dressmaker, is ultra vires the company. Okay, it cannot take place. All right. So we started a little bit late, so I make it. We have about 15 minutes if we take it from the starting point to cover off. So not too bad. What I will do now is I will look at the main exam, and I'll try and narrow this down a bit for you. Okay. So let me just look at the structure for a moment. So as I said, you will find that all of these questions in the exam, they will ultimately have 25 marks. Okay, so I'm going to be taking a score of 100 from you guys in 2 weeks' time, and then I'll translate it back into out of 70. So if you get 50 in the exam, you're going to get. I'm going to give you 35 marks out of the 70 that are assigned to the exam. I will then add back on the tort, the company law, the contract law, the tort assignment, and then also the small test to come to a final result. Okay. So, but basically, what you need to be aware of is there's 25 marks for each of the questions. Okay. And once again, it's four questions. Okay. So please do answer all four. Somebody answered seven last year. Okay. And what happened was she failed three of the seven that she put in. Now she passed the exam, but she failed three of the seven questions. So she was kind of firing darts, if you like, and hoping that one of them hits. It's a risky way of doing it, okay? And it also means that I have extra stuff to mark, okay? Which puts me in a bad mood, which you don't want. So there's four questions. I wouldn't really urge you, if you want to try a fifth. If you're going to say, okay, listen, I really can't decide, I'm not going to be great on either of them, I'm going to fire both of them down and see what happens, there's probably not going to be a massive difference in the score, okay? All right? And I will say you're scoring well on the assignments, which helps, okay? Okay, so you will, that helps bring up. But anyway, question one is from, I'm going to have to be careful, I can read some of this out, not all of it, but so question one is from module one, okay? And there's 25 marks. It's a two-part question. There's 20 marks for the first part and only 5 for the second part, okay? So please allocate your writing time accordingly, okay? So it's from module one. It's from the sources of Irish law. It's very similar to the one that's in the mock exam. It's very, very, very similar, actually. Okay. Well, you can read into that what you will. There were three varies in there, so that would tell you a bit. So the first part of it, the 20 marks piece is very similar, very, very, very similar to what's in the exam. Okay. Now there's a second piece. So in the mock exam we had a second piece, it was 10 and 10. Second piece. The second one was in the mock exam was what's the difference between criminal law and civil law? It's a very similar question. I'll start the question actually for you. It's explain the difference between. And it's not criminal and it's not civil, but it's another type of two types of law. All right? Now, there's only 5 marks available for it. But that said, 5 marks is, when you keep in mind, 5 marks is worth more than each of those short tests you would have done, you know? And I had people patiently emailing me back saying, oh, I think you find I got 9 instead of 8s and so on and so that. So, you know, that said, it's five marks, do allocate your time correctly, but it's still 5 marks, okay? So worth getting right, okay? Question 2 is also from module one. So module one is, it's divided into two sections. You have the kind of sources of Irish law, and then your second half of that module is your contract law, okay? This is from the contract law piece, okay? So again, it's very similar to what is in the mock exam. Let me just check which question it's quite similar to, just bear with me a second, because I'm not sure it's question 2. Actually, to save me some time,
is that the mock one?
That is the mock one. I didn't bring out copies of the real one. It's quite similar to. It's not question 2. It's quite similar to. So quite similar to question 3 in the mock exam. So question 3 on the mock exam is on contract law. So we're on question 2 of the real one. Okay. Mm-hmm. It's quite similar to question 3, okay? Mm-hmm. It's phrased a bit differently, but if you're able to answer that, you'd probably be able to answer this, okay? Okay? Now, question 2 on the real exam, exactly the same structure as question 1. There's 20 points available for the first part, and there's 5 available for the second part. For the first part, it's very, very similar, okay? For the second part, on the mock exam, it said, explain what is meant by terms of contract and give examples. Okay, we're not asking for terms of contract on this one. We are looking for something down in that part of the notes, though. Okay, there's other stuff down there as well. There is, what is down there? I'm just kind of randomly thinking. There's things like mistake, there's things like how to void a contract, things like that, that kind of stuff. So study those notes. If that's the question you want to go in for, study those notes, okay? Okay, you can forget about your terms and conditions of a contract. You can bring it in if you want, but you don't really have to overly focus on that. Okay? So you did for the mock, but not for the real one. Okay. Question three is, let me see. Question three is also, I was trying to see why I didn't have any notes on that. So actually, if you read up those areas. So again, if you think about your offer, your acceptance, your consideration, if you know all that, and then if you also read down the later part of the notes, like things like mistake and how to avoid a contract, that kind of stuff, you will also be able to answer not just question two, but question three as well. All right. So question three is on contract. Structure is a little bit different. It's 15 for the first bit and 10 for the second bit. But if you read all of that stuff in and around there, you will not only be able to do question two, but you'll be able to do question three. Okay? So basically, if you know your contract, you know it well, that's half your exam sorted. Okay? Question two and question three are all about contract and only about contract. Okay? Doesn't bring in EU law or company law or anything else. Okay? All right. So that's question three.
Sorry, Paul. For these questions, do we need to bring in the kind of precedent cases as well?
The bits of the law where I would use precedent quite a bit would be contract law and then also tort. There's quite a few cases on both. Okay, if the cases are there, learn the names of them. Okay, mm-hmm. If there's no cases, I don't expect you to go off and find cases somewhere else in the world. Okay, they're not in the notes. I don't expect to get them. All right.
For question two and three, you're saying they're overlapping, but primarily looking at contract law.
They're only looking at contract law. Yeah. So basically, if you study your contract law from A to Z, you can definitely do question two and question three, and you can skip the terms contract, the stuff that was in that question on terms of contract that was in the mock exam. You can skip that bit. Now only that bit. Don't skip the whole lot, but you can skip that particular bit because you don't need to bring it in. All right. Question four comes from module two, which is company law. Okay, it is a tricky question. I'll warn you that. So I would only do question four if you study company law well. I'm going to narrow it down for you actually, because it's you learn your marks in the exam if you do this one. It's on insolvency. Okay, so if you study insolvency, maybe you know a lot about insolvency. Maybe you've been through it. If you've been through it, then maybe think about it. But I've read the question, and when I was preparing this, I said, I wouldn't do it if I was a student. But it's on insolvency. If you know insolvency well, it's not particularly difficult. But if you don't know insolvency well, then I'd steer clear of it. Okay. Question five also comes from company law. Okay. It's a two-parter. There's 20 marks for the first bit, and then 5 for the second bit.
Sorry, question five is
company law. So I'll do a quick recap just at the end, just to kind of give you the general, this is company, this is contract, this is whatever, but just in case anyone got confused. And do ask, okay? Because the absolute last thing I want is that somebody goes to the exam with one idea in their head, and they leave and they complain to Declan on the way. I said, Paul told us that four was company and it was contract.
Four or five, they're on company law, are they, yeah?
Yeah, okay, so let me recap where we've gone so far, okay? So question one is from the sources of Irish law, okay? Question two is on contract law. Question three is also on contract law. Yeah. Question four is company law, specifically insolvency, I'll give you that. And question five is also on company law. Okay?
Specifically?
There's more hints coming up, but let me see. So in terms of extra guidance, the first part is very similar to a question on the mock exam. So what questions do we have on the mock exam on company law? Question four and question five from the mock exam are on company law. It's very similar to question four. Okay. The second part is a bit different. Asking a slightly different question. Yeah, I mean, the two parts of the question are very interrelated. If you can answer the first part, you can probably give a pretty good stab at the second part. Okay? And there's only 5 marks going for it anyway. Okay? It's phrased a little bit differently, but it'll make sense when you see it. Okay? But it's very, very similar to question four. So I'm talking about question five on the real one, very similar to question four on the mock one. This is confusing. It can be. So do ask the questions, okay? If you're in any way confused, ask the questions. I want to get this right. Okay? Question six comes from EU law, okay? Again, it's a two-parter, 20 marks and then 5 marks, okay? So in terms of your 20-mark question,
It's about one of the EU institutions. So we're asking you either about the word discuss is in there, so tell us if it's good or if it's bad, okay? Mm-hmm. And there is also a request for a bit of case law as well. Might be a little bit flexible on that, we'll see. So it's about one of the EU institutions. So we're either asking you about the Commission, the Council of Ministers, the Parliament, or the European Court of Justice, okay? So we're asking you to talk about one of those. And the word discuss is in there, so tell us what you like and what you don't like. EU law is one of the trickier parts, okay?
What module is that?
That is module 3. It's one of the trickier and longer parts of the law. Given you only have to do 4 out of 8, might be one to steer clear of. But mind you, I like a bit of variety when I'm answering the questions. So, it's boring if they're all the same. So. Okay. So it's one of the EU institutions. So the first part is talk about that EU institution. Second part is basically just how they apply, how what the that institution does affects us. How do we apply? How does it apply to Ireland? Okay. Now question 7. So listen up very carefully for question 7. Because the clue is a sum total of 3 words, okay? Review your assignment, okay?
Which one?
It's module 4, it's on tort, okay? So the only clue I'll give you is review your assignment. Okay?
Is that just one question or is it 2 parts?
Sorry, it's a fair question. Yeah, it's 2 parts, yeah. 20 marks for the first and then 5 for the second. But your assignment will cover both the 20 and the 5. Okay? And then finally, question 8 is exactly, it's not the same things, but it's exactly the same format as you see here, okay? All right, so on the mock one we had, okay, so we have uber dictum, we have the literal rule, we have caveat emptor, we have invitation to treat, and we have ultra vires. So so there's 5 of them, there's a 5 of them there. There is some overlap. I'll give you that. Some overlap. Yeah.
How many?
2. So there's some overlap there. So let me see. Is there anything else I've noted down on that? Is it 2 or is it 3, actually? Is it 3?
No
shows. No. Yeah. How many? Come up. That's only 2. It's only two. So 2 of them are the same as they are from the mock paper. Okay. And then you got 3 new ones. Okay.
Can you please repeat the question 8 again, please?
Question 8. So it's exactly the same format as you have in the mock one. Mm-hmm. You got 5 themes from scattered throughout the course, and you need to tell me about. Now let me see. Just. You need to do. Yeah, you need to all. Yeah, you need to do all 5 of them. Yeah.
And where are the other ones?
So where did you get the other ones? Let me see. If you followed, let me see. There's one on tort. There's one on tort. There's 2 on contract, and there's 2 from right at the beginning, the kind of sources of the law, that kind of stuff. There's one on tort, so there's 5 there. One of them is on tort.
Yeah.
2 are on contract, yeah. And 2 are on sources of the law, kind of right at the beginning, the early part of the, you know, the constitution, the legislation, the judicial precedent, that kind of stuff. So.
You mentioned earlier that rather than saying. Citing case studies, just saying like a brief synopsis, like not even explaining them in detail, just
referencing. Yeah, when you're talking about something, if you want to make a point, you want to back it up with a case. This reminds me of Paul versus Declan because, or this reminds me of Paul versus Declan, but it's different to Paul versus Declan because of this. That would be the way. Don't go into. Paul bought a horse, and Declan thought it was going to be a car, and that kind of. Don't go into that. You can assume I know them. Okay. So, is there any more guidance I can give you? I mean, let me see. I mean, I will say it's probably worth saying. You know, your way to approach this probably depends on what you want. Okay. I mean, there are people who would be perfectly happy to pass this exam, and maybe do a little, pass it and pass it comfortably, and that's fine. Okay. There's nothing wrong with that. There are others who, when I give them 85, 90%, they email me back and say, how come I lost kind of 8 marks there or 10 marks there if you're telling me it was nearly perfect? So there are other people who are really shooting for the high marks, okay? So if you are shooting for the high marks, you need to differentiate yourself from the rest of the crowd, okay? I cannot and will not give everybody 90%, okay? I don't see any reason, there's no reason why anyone should fail, okay? I mean, that's one thing to call out, okay? If you do the work, you do the study, and you turn up and you do 4 proper questions, there's no reason for you to expect to fail, okay? But that said, there's no reason for you to expect to get 90, 95% either, okay, unless you're differentiating yourself from everybody else, okay? So if you give me longer answers, and you give me more detailed answers, and you just put more in, as long as it's relevant to the question, you will score higher than the next exam script which I pick up, which maybe just gives me the notes but nothing more, okay? If you give me, show me clear understanding that you can do it and that you know what you're talking about, you're more likely to get other marks. They are not the assignments, though, okay? So do keep that in mind, okay? Because some people start off, occasionally see this in exams, people start off and they're really, really, really good. And the problem is that then, I'm then flicking through the later questions, hang on a sec, you only did half a page on that, a third of a page on that, a quarter of a page on that. So that's because they treat it like the assignments, and they start putting in everything they know, and they start tailoring it to, you know, it'd make a great assignment, but it's not what I'm looking for. You only have a certain amount of time, okay? So I would say that. What else would I say? I do correct them all together. So in that, the first thing I do is I put number 1, number 2, number 3 in terms of the questions you've answered, and I do all the number 1s together, all the number 2s, number 3s, and so on. So you are being compared against your peers, okay? And the final results are not put in until I've read all of them, okay? Which is a bit unlike the assignments, because sometimes you get... if you're in first on the assignments, I can tell you this now, but because your assignments are pretty much over, but if you're in first with the assignments, you know, sometimes they score a bit higher and they say, oh, cheaper, there's an awful lot better ones that came in afterwards. Maybe I gave a bit too generous on that one, yeah. So it's not like the assignments, the final marks only go in when I've read all the questions and all the answers, okay? So that's it. I mean, you know, the notes and show an understanding, bit of case law. Where applicable, that'd be perfect if you want to get kind of, you know, you won't just pass, you'll get kind of, you know, 60 or so, you know, 60, 65, that kind of stuff. And then if you scored well in your other assignments, that might even bring you up into the 70s. But if you're shooting for the real top, you need to differentiate yourself a bit from everybody else. So I'd be expecting a bit more detail, a bit more discussion, points where I read a point and said, nobody else put that in, that's good. You know, that kind of stuff. Okay. But make sure you get the basics in as well, okay? Don't go off and start discussing stuff until you've given me, and then forget to give me the basic points, you know? And do answer the question asked, okay? Don't give me everything you know about contract law. Okay, on that, best of luck.
Thank you. Yep. Thank you.